If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
How's the nerves holding up? A tight draw in Madrid has left Manchester City in a good position in the Champions League semi-final, while the finishing line is in sight in the Premier League. After beating Leeds last weekend, City are now 8 points away from the title, barring a ridiculous and unlikely goal difference swing. But let's call it 3 wins from the final 4 games, just to be safe. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon podcast, where there's no time for joking around, because there's big games coming out of our ears. It's Everton away next, a notoriously tricky game, even despite their recent struggles, and nobody's taking that for granted. We'll chat through that and the Real Madrid second leg coming up next week later on the show. Also on today's show, we'll focus on Erling Haaland. He's got the record for the best ever Premier League goal scoring season, so we've gathered the thoughts of a load of opposition managers to find out how they've tried and failed to stop him. We'll also hear from our EDS expert Sean Blinkhorn to find out more about how the younger age groups have got on this season, and the business end of the season demands a no-nonsense set of guests too. I'm David Mooney, and we're pulling out all the stops as I'm joined by the Daily Mail's Jack Gawn.
Hello, David. You all right?
Not too bad, thank you, Jack. And One Football's Dan Burke.
Hello, David.
How are you doing, Dan?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. Jack, you well?
Yes, yeah. Feeling, as a journalist that covers Manchester City, feeling very cold and unenthusiastic, as people say these days.
I don't.
Which is an awful, awful in-joke, which probably the majority, hopefully the majority of the podcast listeners won't understand, so apologies.
I will not hear a word of it, mate. I will not hear a word of it. Jack, you were in Madrid. First off, what was the game like? Because I could only watch it on the telly, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a brilliant game, and I thought City were fantastic. What was it like there?
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. Every time I go to the Bernabeu, it's an incredible spectacle. I thought... Yeah, they approached the game in a really positive manner, and obviously dominated it for half an hour, which was quite an intriguing first half, really, with the way that Real Madrid approached it and how City wanted to impress themselves on the game. And then, but probably the most impressive thing I thought about the night from a City perspective was the way they hung in and dug in for that 20 minutes after half time, which, you know, a few years ago that.
It got ropey,
might not have happened. Yeah, they might have conceded another or a couple more. So, yeah, it was really really positive, and they obviously go into next week as slight favourites now.
Yeah, I got home from work not long before kickoff, and I had to make me tea. So you know, you shouldn't leave food unattended on while it's on the hob. I kept having to rush back into the kitchen to check that everything was fine, so I could run back in. And every time I came back into the living room to see the telly. City just had possession of the ball again around the edge of the box. And Dan, like I can't explain how much that settles the nerves. It's fantastic, isn't it? Just watching a team as good as City go to a place against a team as good as Real Madrid, especially in the Champions League, and just control it in the opening stages.
Yeah, I mean, I perhaps naively wasn't very nervous about this game. I was more excited than anything. I was kind of expecting us to go there and really stamp our authority on the game and play really well and dominate the ball like we did for that first 25-30 minutes. You know, it was really good. It was really controlled. It really quietened down the crowd at the Bernabeu. And I think what you have to say about it as well is that Madrid probably anticipated that was the way the game was going to go. And the way they defended it made it hard, even though City had a lot of the ball and were really in control. It made us hard to create much in terms of like clear-cut chances. And, you know, Rodri had that one from outside the box. De Bruyne had a shot from outside the box in the first half. Haaland had that header. But there wasn't anything clear-cut coming, really. I think Madrid, they sat deep and they did a good job of shutting off the flanks. And I think it perhaps gave the illusion of kind of total control a bit more than it actually was. And I think Madrid were kind of biding their time a little bit, really. And you saw the game change a little bit just before the goal. And there was a couple of moments on both wings where they kind of duped City into pressing them and played like a nice little 1-2 and got up the pitch. And the second one of those was the one that when Vinicius broke through the press and Camavinga broke through the press and played it to Vinicius and then he scored. So yeah, I think it's kind of a hard game to analyse because there were some really good things that City did and some really good things that Madrid did, some things that City did that weren't so great. But overall, I think the result is just more important than the performance, really, and the result was a really good one.
I was quite interested in it in the sense that there's not actually... I didn't think there were that many talking points after it. I thought it was just two brilliant teams, both going at each other with different styles. But it was... Yeah, I just found it. I was thinking about what to write yesterday morning as like a follow up, and like there weren't any major topics to go at, which I quite unusual for a game of that magnitude. I thought.
Yeah, I thought in a weird way, Jack, that as individuals, City's players weren't actually that good, but as a team performance, it was really good. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I would say. Yeah, I thought they were. They were great in their shape. Everyone knew the roles. It was a sort of sloppiness on the ball, I thought, which is a little bit of a shame in and around the box. Like, I don't know how much of it got picked up on the telly, but Guardiola was going mad at pretty much everybody got
a
little bit of a talking to at one point by him. There was one where they were in the second half. I think it was sort of between the 70th and 80th minute, and they had quite a good little bit of possession in the middle third, and they were popping it about quite quick, and then Grealish hit a ball into Gundogan and like caned it into his chest from about 10 yards, and they got turned over quite quick, and you go, those are the margins, aren't they? You know, one poor ball like that and you've got five men ahead of the ball, and Real are so good at counter-attacking or transitioning that could be the game there. So it's one of those things where they got to be mindful of that on next Wednesday, which is why I don't think they'll play much differently. I think it'll be quite pragmatic in a way, and I think it'd be Bernardo out on the right again, and they'll try and slow the game down and just pass Real to death if they can.
Yeah, interesting in the way after the game, Dan, that Guardiola, he said to the telly, that Madrid scored when City were better and City scored when Madrid were better.
yeah.
And I guess that kind of sums up the game, doesn't it?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think there was both teams really defended well, I would say. I think City defended the box really well. Obviously, Real Madrid did. Both goals were wonder goals from outside the area. And, you know, we didn't give Madrid that many other chances, even towards the end where they were really pushing for that second goal. You know, they had that Benzema header. Apart from that, there wasn't much for them to sort of grasp onto, really. And I wonder if maybe there's a little bit more kind of emotional intelligence to City this season after what happened last year as well. And also, these two-legged games, they're always more of a kind of attritional affair than normal games. Obviously, it's a 180-minute match, isn't it, that you played essentially with, you know, a leg in each ground, and the way that you react to conceding a goal after 35 minutes in a 180-minute match is very different to how you would react if it was in a 90-minute match. You know, there's a long way to go, and it's about just kind of hanging in there. I was just thinking when we went 1-0 down, okay, this is fine. Just don't concede another goal now. Yeah. Don't make that gap get any bigger. And I think the way the game finished was quite instructive of how the two teams feel about where they are as things stand. I don't think Madrid will be nearly as happy with the 1-1 as we are. And you could see the way they were almost frantically trying to get a second goal at the end, whereas we seem to just be happy to kind of hold on to what we have. And I think next week it'll be our turn to turn up the heat. And Jack's right, I think we could have kept the ball better at times. You know, I think Bernardo was guilty of being a bit sloppy in possession at some times, which I found quite frustrating. But it was also a case that Madrid's closing down was really good. It was really hard for City to settle on the ball. And I was kind of thinking the way the game was going, maybe there's a chance for us to break and get a second goal late in the game here. There was one moment when I think De Bruyne could have played Haaland in, and he didn't make the pass. But
I was gonna mention this one because of all that, that was I think that was like it was like they added 4 minutes or something, and that was on like 92. And I was really torn between the idea of what, like, just don't do the thing that means you conceded a goal in the last minute in this game and like ruin you 1-1, because 1-1's fantastic, but think of the prize, you know, think if you can get exactly. that through, think of that prize, yeah.
Yeah, but the prize now is that it's a straight shootout on our ground next week. So we're in not an ideal situation necessarily, but a really good situation. So I'm very comfortable with how it went on the night.
Yeah, Jack. I don't know if this was true of kind of Guardiola throughout the game, but every time the TV seemed to cut to him, he was kind of doing that thing where he was crouched on his haunches in the edge of the touchline. It looked a really stressful game for him more than anything else as well.
I didn't notice him crouching that much, actually. He was crouching a lot against Leeds last week.
I mean, the end of that game, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is. There's so much that goes with Guardiola and that specific game on Tuesday night, and, you know, the record in the Champions League, and he is obviously hurt at people's criticism of his record in Europe since leaving Barcelona.
Mentions it a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah. Plus going to the Bernabeu, where there's no love lost. And added to that, you're playing a really good team and you're desperate to go through. So he looked pretty shattered at the end when we spoke to him. I think he was ready to go home.
Is it true that he doesn't eat and stuff before games because of nerves? So I mean, by the time it's like it's midnight, by the time he's speaking to you in Madrid, he's probably starving, isn't he? He's just like drained by no energy.
I think before he speaks to us, I don't know how much he eats, but he definitely downs a glass of wine because he'll probably need it after a night like that.
Yeah.
It was interesting. It was there was a kind of moment on Tuesday where there was a passage of play. I can't really remember what happened, but someone gave the ball away, but it was the right idea in Real's third, and he was clapping, quite enthusiastically clapping above his head. And the whole ground just started booing him. Can you imagine what that must feel like? Like, you sort of forget.
He loves it, doesn't he?
I know, but you kind of forget like the personal sort of toil like nights like that can take on someone.
Mm.
Like, we just see it as, you know, there's a game and it's a really important game, they want to win, whatever. But there are so many different layers to it with Guardiola. And it just that was all just crystallised in that moment where manager claps players and 70,000 people go, piss off, mate.
Yeah, he's talked about this, not in depth in the past, but it is that sort of idea of, like, ultimately I make the decision that I feel is right, and it might be the right or the wrong one, but then loads of people judge me for making that decision. Like, he's talked about that in the past, hasn't he, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, my argument would be stop reading Twitter. would be the... It baffles me that baffled me that he's that bothered about sort of public perception.
I get that. I understand it.
He's the greatest manager that's ever, you know, arguably the greatest manager that's ever lived. He's completely dominated English football for the last 6 years. Like, he's got nothing to prove to anyone. So doesn't matter what, you know, Joe Bloggs writes in a column for the Daily Bugle, does it? Like, why is he bothered? It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. Just looking back at the game, Dan, I mean, the big talking point around City's goal was whether the ball was out or not. We can clear up why, very easily, why the VAR didn't get involved. And it's because Madrid had possession. So they had control possession. They gave it away themselves. There's no reason to go back further than that because it's a new phase of play. And on top of that, the VAR would need conclusive proof that it's gone out. And, you know, a graphic designed by beIN Sports isn't actually conclusive proof.
Do we know whether Keyes was doing it?
I don't know. But what I will say, in all of that, though, Dan, City might have been a bit lucky with it.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. Should the linesman flag if he doesn't know, or should the referee? Probably not, really. You should give advantage to the attacking team in that scenario. Yeah, that 3D graphic that was doing that. I know we live in a sort of post-truth society nowadays, but even I was a bit surprised by how little scepticism there was about this, like, 3D technology that beIN Sports apparently have access to. And yeah, Arsene Wenger
sort of conclusive proof. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, Arsene Wenger sort of muddied the waters afterwards when he was asked about it as well, didn't he? Which wasn't very helpful. So yeah. yeah, maybe City were a bit luckier there. I don't really know. I mean, I don't really care. At the end of the day, Madrid got the ball back, didn't they? And they still gave it away. And I think Ancelotti's comments about it were quite calculated after the game as well. I think even he knows he was talking shite about that, but he was just trying to sort of like redress the narrative or something, whatever. You know, bit of a perhaps say a throwback to his Everton days. That
I did actually in the ground when the ball did or didn't go out. I was like, why have you not like gathered that ball in there? I thought it was out. And it just felt around the ground, it just felt as if it was, if you know what I mean. There was just the feeling, oh yeah, that ball's gone out. But as you said, it don't matter, does it? Like, they've got the ball back and then it's the second phase. So,
but at the same time, Jack, did you get the sense that Madrid were roughing up City a little bit? And I mean, there was a couple of challenges that were, I'd say, on the industrial end of the friendly industrial scale.
Yeah, it's happened a lot recently. Leeds were doing it at the weekend as well, weren't they? When Forshaw just completely poleaxed Rico Lewis within about 60 seconds of the game starting.
Everyone defended him this time, though, didn't they? So No happy flowers here. Yeah,
he did the words. Grealish was on the end of one from Carvajal, wasn't he? Which was really, I mean, that was really naughty, that. And then Gundogan got two or three.
Yeah.
The Cruz tackle was an awful tackle, but the Rudiger sort of, I don't know, elbowy shove was reminiscent of the one he gave to De Bruyne in the 2021 final in Porto. And obviously, fractured his eye socket. That Rudiger one could have been really nasty if he caught him in the wrong place. But
we didn't get a foul for that, I don't think, did we?
No, that was play on.
But it's what teams do, isn't it? To try and unsettle City. You've got to, when they move the ball so quickly, you've got to find a way of getting in amongst them. And if you can't beat them, kick them.
Yeah, but that's the thing, isn't it? It's like I thought, as much as City were being roughed up, they didn't let it get to them. They just kind of, I'm not going to say they didn't rise to it, because Grealish was on the very edge of rising to it, and I think he plays that kind of panto villain very well, actually. But there was almost this sense of, yeah, they're doing this to us, and I mean, maybe it's my blue tinted specs and my blue trilby that I've got on, but I don't know if City were kind of doing it back, or if they were just coping with it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you do. It's quite rare that you see them retaliate. Obviously, Grealish had one at Fulham the other week, didn't he? But yeah, they normally take it in the stride. Is it, as long as you're not hurt, you take it as a compliment, don't you?
Yeah.
That this is, you know, as I said before,
that's all you got. Yeah.
Reducing to kicking him, then thanks very much.
I mean, we sort of gave as good as we got, I thought, as well. Bernardo left one on one of their players, I think, in the first half, didn't he? Rodri was getting very sort of handsy at times. I think that you've got to be willing to fight and stand up for yourselves in these moments, in these games. And I think City have got that in them. I think they relish those battles, and it drives them on. Like, you know, Grealish getting in Carvajal's face. I mean, how he didn't get booked, I'll never know. But he didn't get three bookings even in the first half. But yeah, it was. I think it's just part of this level of football, really.
Yeah, it's sort of a respect thing either way as well, though, because did you see Walker and, was it Vinicius afterwards?
Yeah.
The video where they just, like, it was like two old friends who had had, like, a real go at each other throughout the 90 minutes. It's like, you're not friends, you've never met each other before, surely.
Yeah, they just love those challenges, don't they?
Someone on Twitter put that photo of them high-fiving each other alongside the Pelé and Bobby Moore picture. I was like, I mean, it was a good battle, but let's, you know, can we calm down, please?
Yeah, feet on the ground.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
While we're talking about that era of England as well, speaking of Gordon Banks, let's talk about Edison, because he made some important saves in Madrid, didn't he, Jack?
Yeah, and I think he's been really good for the last 4 to 6 weeks. There was loads and loads of criticism of him, not so long ago, and he just wasn't really producing from a shot-stopping point of view, but he's been really, really good recently. The game at Bayern, he played well at Bayern, made some decent saves, yeah. And you two be different as supporters, but I feel a bit more sort of confident when teams are approaching City's box that actually Edison will go and bail them out now in a way that I probably wasn't beforehand.
Yeah, I'm not 100% convinced still this season, but
do you think he should have saved the goal?
No, I don't. I think
there was
really
a lot of that, wasn't there? There was people moaning that.
I think that's just Edison. I think that's people who don't like Edison for his goalkeeping looking for things to criticise him for. I think the goal. Yeah, it's not in the corner. Yeah, it's a little way out, but he hits it that hard. I don't think you can react to that as easily as people seem to say that. I mean, we've talked about wanting to see big saves from him, Dan, and that's what it's been in the last few weeks, hasn't it? Those moments, there's been some really big and important saves.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the saves he made in this game were anything out of the ordinary, really. I mean, the Benzema one from the header on first glance looked like an amazing save, and then when you see it, it's actually not a particularly great header. It's kind of straight at him, and the Tchouaméni save in the second half, again, it's a really hard shot, but it's quite close to his body, and you'd expect a top-level keeper to make that save all the time, really, 10 times out of 10, I would say. But the difference is, obviously, like we've said, even in the past, he wasn't making those sort of saves often enough, and I think it just makes such a difference to the whole team when you can rely on your goalkeeper to make those saves, to not concede some of the easier shots. Something to build on every single game, and you know, Edison's been an integral part of how City play for many years now, and will be for probably many years to come. You know, the stuff that he does with his feet is so crucial to City, and I wonder if maybe the competition from Ortega this season has maybe put him on his toes a little bit more now that he knows that he's got an understudy who is good with his feet as well and does make those saves. You know, when Ortega came in the other week, you weren't concerned about him playing at all, really, were you? And he played well, so. Yeah, I think those two are perhaps pushing each other on, and it's really good for City that Edison has found this form.
I think the best example of Edison recently is the save he made when Carlos Vinicius was going through at Fulham. I think it was 2-1 at the time, and Fulham were playing really well. And there was a little bit of a mix-up at the back, and Edison came and saved it at Vinicius' feet on the edge of his own box, where previously you're thinking he comes rushing out like that, is he going to bring him down? Are they going to concede the penalty?
Yeah.
You know, they draw that game and the season looks completely different, doesn't it?
Yeah. We'll get on to how the season will look with the Everton game shortly. Also look at the second leg with Real Madrid. But first I want to have a quick look at the Leeds game as well, because we've not really talked about that. Jack Guardiola was really pissed off about the penalty incident at the end of that, and Haaland giving it over to Gundogan. Was he right, or was that a bit of an overreaction, or is it actually weirdly a bit of both?
Probably a bit of both, actually, because he was apoplectic on the touchline, and then by the time he'd come inside to see us, he'd sort of calmed down a little bit, but then made some pointed remarks that Haaland's a taker, and if it's not Haaland, it's Mahrez. Like, we're not running a charity here. Like, it was only 2-0. And he is right. I can't remember what time the penalty was at. It was about 80 minutes.
Yeah, it was like 2 minutes before Leeds' goal. It was like really...
I think the problem with it was, it felt like a testimonial for ages, that game.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone was sat there going, Leeds are going to get back into this. And that obviously transmitted onto the pitch, and sort of forgot that, oh, it's a cliche, but 2-0 is dangerous, isn't it? And any team in the division can go up the other end and score, and it can make it quite nervous. But it's just, I think they felt so comfortable and so confident that the game was won, that it was like, all right, you go and have it. But yeah, it won't happen again, will it? So it's probably, weirdly, in hindsight, it's probably a good thing it happened.
Yeah. There's a kind of a bigger picture thing to this as well, Danny, because I wonder, had it gone 3-0 at that point, I wonder if the subs board goes up and Haaland and De Bruyne come off.
Yeah, I mean, if Pep was that concerned about that, surely he could have made sure that Gundogan didn't take the penalty, just like shout over and say, no, don't take it, let Haaland take it. It seemed like a bit of a kind of, it reminded me a bit actually of last year when Mahrez missed the penalty away at West Ham. And after the game, there was loads of people on Twitter saying, why didn't De Bruyne take it? And it's like, because Mahrez is the penalty taker. You can't just sort of work backwards when someone misses a penalty and say someone else should have taken that. And like, you know, I was quite happy to see Gundogan take the penalty. He's, you know, been a decent penalty taker in the past. He's missed a few, obviously, but he scored some, and I thought, you know, it would have been nice if he'd got his first hat trick. But yeah, I mean, I take the point that you want to finish the game off and see it out in that situation. But I mean, I thought Gundogan was going to score, so and he very nearly did. It sort of hit the post, didn't it? So I think it was a bit of an odd one from Pep, really.
Yeah. What does it say about Haaland though, Jack, that he would do that? Because Guardiola talked about it being about him and his personality in the press conference afterwards, and it did make me kind of think that there's a contradiction there, because Haaland is the machine who wants to score at all times, and yet here he is going, well, go on, mate, you get yourself a hat trick, your first career hat trick, probably the only one you'll ever get.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing that's surprised staff at the club more than anything else about Haaland this year, is just how selfless he is and wants, above all else, wants the team to do well, which is obviously quite an easy thing to say, but there is an element of surprise about how much of a team player he is, which is, as you sort of alluded to, it is a massive contradiction, really, isn't it? Particularly when you look at the amount of goals he's got and you go,
you think you can't score that many without being really selfish?
No, but if you like marry those numbers up with someone who actually, you know, wants to link with the team, and you've seen it in his improvement with his hold up play and the way he interacts with midfield, that he is working really hard on making himself a proper Man City player who can lead that line and they can play a similar way to they always have. If you can marry that up with the numbers, then you've got, like, it's frightening, isn't it? Absolutely, yeah. Frightening. And it's great for them that they've got, he's probably the first superstar they've signed, actually ready-made superstar they've signed since Robinho. And the fact they've signed one who takes, like, I don't know, a holistic view to himself and his teammates is, yeah, it's incredible, incredible business.
Yeah, I do have to be careful with the Haaland praise, because if I'm not, then I've suddenly made him the greatest man on earth, and that, like, you know what I mean? It's like, it's very easy to get carried away by praising him like that.
I mean, all that stuff that Pep was saying about, oh, he's so generous and all that, it's like, well, he scored 51 goals this season. Like, it's like saying Jeff Bezos is generous if he gives you a fiver or something, isn't it, really? Like,
that's, yeah. Just while we're on the penalty and Gundogan, Jack, did you? I saw a story from you recently about Gundogan and his future. Am I making that up? Have I seen that?
I wrote something on Gundogan last week about how it'd be a travesty if he goes, which I think it would be. It's difficult to find someone that is capable of doing what Gundogan does, while also understanding he's like Pep on the pitch, isn't he?
Yeah,
He is Pep, and you can, you know, obviously the next door neighbours, and you can see it with the interaction between each other, that he would leave a massive, massive hole in that squad if he was to go in the summer.
What's he got on that? Are you thinking he's likely to?
It's looking more likely that he'll go. Barcelona offering a 2-year contract, albeit on significantly less money. It won't all be down to length of contracts. There's other elements, like, particularly if they win the Champions League and he's won everything, you go, is now the time to say goodbye. But equally, City need to know what he's doing pretty quick, because it impacts on it's quite ruthless, isn't it? But it impacts on their transfer business in the summer. Yeah. It's all well and good sort of giving him the time he needs, but they're going to, they're going to have to replace him pretty sharpish. And all right, they will have people that they like that would come in and try and fill that void if Gundogan were to go. But the sort of players that they'll want are the ones that all the top teams want. So you're sort of behind everybody else a little bit while you wait for him to make a decision.
Yeah. Is there an issue, Dan, if Gundogan leaves this summer and then Bernardo goes as well?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I can't really understand why they would only offer Gundogan a one-year extension if that's the case. You know, he's 32, but he's club captain. You know, he's still really sort of peak of his powers. He's playing really, really well. I don't understand it. And I feel like they probably would have reached an agreement with him by now if he was going to stay. And there's been all the talk about Barcelona, obviously. So it seems to me like he's off and there's always going to be talk about Bernardo. I just kind of wonder who's going to come in for him this summer if Gundogan's going to Barcelona and, you know, they've got lots of issues off the pitch. I can't see them being able to afford the kind of money that City would want for Bernardo. I don't know, maybe PSG come in for him, but I think he'd be mad to go there personally. You know, I know Paris is a nice city and all that, but in footballing terms, it's a huge step down from City the way that club is being run at the moment. So I'm kind of wondering if there's a big signing lined up here. You know, it's probably not going to be Bellingham. That seems quite unlikely, but there's been a bit more talk about Mateo Kovacic from Chelsea in recent days, who is a pretty good player, but I don't know if I'd be, you know, too happy about Gundogan and Bernardo leaving and him coming in. I suppose we've got James Bakayoko coming back from Sheffield United. And if one of those leave, then it presents a bit more of a pathway to him in the first team. But it's a young player. Like, yeah, so it's a bit of a confusing situation at the moment. I just hope they've got a clear plan in mind.
Yeah. Final thought for the first part of the show, Jack. Rico Lewis, you mentioned him before getting basically taken out in the first moments of the Leeds game. But, I mean, given that happened and given what he was asked to do and the way he played, I thought he was utterly brilliant. I can't speak highly enough of someone who is, as young as he is, coming into the team, asked to do the role he does and just being as brave as he was on the ball.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he? He's still got a long way to go technically, but to have that sort of head on your shoulders and brain and understanding for the role and what you need to do at that age stands him in really, really good stead. Like I'm going out to Georgia to cover the England under-21s who've got European Championship in June, a week after the Champions League final. And Lewis will be in that squad, and I'm fascinated to see how he does against players his own age and how much better he is than the other sort of 18, 19, 20 year olds around Europe, because there is the potential for him to be just like an absolute star during that 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
For everything that, you know, he's not actually played that many games this year, but for him to show what he's learned on a different stage is a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah. He's played, weirdly for someone his age, I think he's played a lot more than you'd expect as well. Like, you think of how many,
there is that. Yeah. But if you just look at the like raw numbers, it's like, he's played, I don't know what it is, 15 games or whatever, which is more than you would expect. But actually, sort of minutes on the pitch, it hasn't been
that big. Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is that his trajectory is far quicker than the minutes he's been given.
Yeah, I know what you mean. The other side of his personality, Dan, is just his ability to belong in the team. I mean, take the Leeds game, for instance. He bolted De Bruyne at one point for not giving him the ball. Like, that's like, who does that? And then there was a moment where City were on the counter and he just dummied it to let it run through to Gundogan. And I was like, this kid, like, he's just living his best life on that pitch.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, was that his first start since Spurs away?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it is. And he played sort of left-back that day, didn't he? He played the inverted left-back. Looked a bit uncomfortable. You know, wasn't the only one who didn't have a great game that day. And that cost him his place in the team for a while. I think it was probably circumstantial as well that we wanted to change and get the experienced players in the team a bit more. But the fact that he can come back into the team after months of not being involved and just kind of pick up where he left off was really impressive as well. And his personality, he plays and carries himself like a 30-year-old. Like, it's scary how good he's going to be if he keeps developing at this rate. And I think he's really important to the way City build up, and probably plays that inverted full-back role better than anywhere else in the team, even better than John Stones, I would say. I'd be interested to know if he can play a kind of, you know, normal full-back role at some point as well, how he fares there. I think, you know, if there's one kind of weakness to his game at the moment, it's perhaps that he might be a little, I don't want to say suspect, but in sort of one-on-ones and duels and stuff like that, he's perhaps not as good as some of the more experienced players around him. But I think the best thing you could say about him is that, like, Pep could start him in any game and you wouldn't be worried, would you? Even if he played against Real Madrid next week, I would not be worried about that at all. I'd be eager to see what he could do, if anything. So, yeah, great little player. I love him.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
We talked about him already, but Erling Haaland is the Premier League's record goalscorer in a single season. Now, we discussed his ridiculous stats on last week's show, but we didn't really have time to look at it properly, recording so soon after he broke the record. So, this week, we've been back through the season to hear from the people he's been terrorising all year, the opposition managers. Sam Roscoe takes a look at what they've been saying about how they're trying to stop him and how it hasn't been working.
Perhaps the biggest surprise in Saturday's win over Leeds was that Erling Haaland didn't score.
Do you make special plans for Erling Haaland?
yeah. I think that, you know, it's, but it's also supply. Stop the supply and stop the big man getting as many chances as he gets. And then you limit his chances for scoring. So stop the supply, but keep an eye on him at all times, particularly in the final third.
That was the new Leeds manager Sam Allardyce speaking before the game. In his defence, he did keep Haaland from scoring, but possibly more by luck than judgement. Haaland missed several one-on-ones, hit the post, and chose not to take the penalty, and that's not really cutting off his supply. This is what Guardiola said he'd do if he was coming up against him.
What he has shown in his career, not here, is difficult to can imagine, but I think as a team, to be involved as less as possible. So when we play against him, when he was in Borussia Dortmund, is try to have 70-80% of ball possession to don't be involved as much as possible.
But nobody has 70-80% possession against City. Arsenal got the closest. This was Mikel Arteta's plan before the recent game at the Etihad.
When they play really far from your goal, they have the capacity to exploit open spaces, and when they are attacking low blocks, now they have a different threat because they are a bit of a physical team right now.
Because of how clinical he is, it's the bigger challenge to stop the supply to him. What can you do when, you know, when he's in front of goal, he's so clinical?
Yeah, well, it's more difficult. Obviously, preventing the source is something that probably is the best recipe.
Haaland scored home and away against Arsenal this season, despite Arteta having time to come up with a game plan. Others weren't as fortunate. Here's West Ham boss David Moyes speaking after the opening day of the season.
The difference with today is if you looked at the Charity Shield game, they had De Bruyne made a couple of passes and very simple, tried to play through exactly what they'd done for the goal, and it was either offside or it didn't quite make it. I think they got very similar run, and it looks like something which all the teams are going to be really aware of. Haaland's runs in behind maybe gives them something different.
The ball in behind was key when he scored his first hat-trick a few weeks later. It was against Crystal Palace. Patrick Vieira spoke afterwards.
Try not to give him so much space inside the box because he's someone who moves quite really well. He's a goal scorer, there's no doubt about it. So I think in the first half we did it quite really well, not give him that space for him to express himself. And then in the second half, when we were a little bit late to put pressure on the ball, when we didn't defend the second ball that well, he was there and take his chances.
Defending as a team and stopping the supply was Vieira's focus when the sides met later in the season too.
He's at the end of all the opportunities that they are creating. But, you know, you need to stop people providing those opportunities. And that's why our performance tomorrow has to be based at the team performance.
It worked better at Selhurst Park, but Haaland still scored through a penalty. Defending as a team hasn't gone much better for plenty of others too. 4 days after scoring a hat-trick against Palace, He did the same to Nottingham Forest.
Harry Kane on Sunday, Haaland, you know, tomorrow, you know, two world-class strikers and goal scorers. And yeah, but I go back to, let's focus on ourselves. Let's remind ourselves that this is what we wanted. This is why we worked as hard as we did last season and throughout our careers. But at the same time, backing ourselves to be as good as we can be.
That was Forest manager Steve Cooper before the match. Here's what he said afterwards.
He's brilliant. He's got the lot, hasn't he? You know, and on the end of it, he scores all the goals as well. So, yeah, we knew we were coming up against, you know, an absolute world-class striker. And he's not the only world-class player in the team, obviously. But still, you have to back yourselves. And, you know, so I don't want to take anything away from his goals tonight, but I am looking at our guys thinking we could have done a bit better.
Even managers who had coached the goal machine at other clubs couldn't stop him. Jesse Marsh was Leeds' boss earlier in the season. He'd been Haaland's manager at Salzburg.
It'll certainly be important for us to manage him on the day. I've been asked many times, how do you do that? And the answer is, I think you just have to have a keen awareness of where he is at all times and where he likes to be. And certainly it's his ability to run hard into the box, his ability to run hard in transition, his ability to do whatever it takes around the goal to get on the ends of plays. So he's often not the one that's starting the play. He's always thinking about where to beat so that he can be finishing it. And his instincts in that manner are incredibly unique. So we will educate the team as to what to expect and then how to try to prevent him from getting into those areas.
Haaland still scored twice at Elland Road. Earlier in the season, and after a Haaland hat-trick in the Manchester derby, Erik ten Hag was asked if it's possible to defend against someone so deadly in front of goal.
Yes, as a team, to defend, and I tried to explain that you have to be front foot and you have to be good in possession. And when you don't do that well, the two elements of football, the opponent is dictating, is dominant, and entering in the box, yeah, and then strikers like Erling Haaland, they have a threat, clear.
Southampton manager Ruben Selles had similar thoughts ahead of the game recently.
I don't think per se one player can change the dynamic of one team. I think that one player can change it if the other 10 are doing the job properly. So the fact that Manchester City now has Haaland in front just make their system a little bit better, because the creation of the chances with Ruben Dias in the build-up, Ederson long distribution, Kevin De Bruyne in the half spaces, Gundogan, Bernardo, Rodri as a central player, they make it possible. And it's not about only Erling Haaland, it's about us, a team that knows how to use their players in the best way possible. So that's what we are focused.
In that game with the Saints, Haaland again scored twice. Against Fulham, he scored once home and away, but only thanks to two penalties. Here's how their manager, Marco Silva, said he'd planned to deal with the Norwegian ahead of the second game.
We have to try to stop the Man City team. The reality, they have so many ways to create for him, and that is difficult to stop. And when I say that it's difficult to stop, was not just Haaland, because if he's not Haaland, it will be another one. I think last game that they played, they were winning clear, and Haaland just got in the last minutes of the game, one goal. So many individual players for us to look at. We prefer to look in a different way, to look for their, in a collective way, that they are strong, one of the best teams in the world, if not the best, and clear the best team in this competition.
So that's several pieces of advice so far. Play high up to keep City away from your own box. Keep the ball to cut down the amount of opportunity City have to find Haaland. Stop the supply when he wants to run in behind. But don't focus so much on him that you forget about his teammates. Even that, though, isn't enough. Haaland is adapting. Here's Burnley manager and former City captain Vincent Kompany.
Haaland has obviously had more pressure than any other player joining, because in the first season at a young age, it's expected for him to already be at his best, but He'll only get better, and you can already see clear signs of improvement in his game. You know, his goal scoring is always unbelievable, but his overall game is improved, and it's only gonna keep improving.
That was ahead of the FA Cup tie earlier this season. Kompany was also asked if he could have defended against Haaland.
I've played against the greats of this time. You know, your Messi's, Ronaldinho's, Zidane, all these guys, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo. in the end, they're part of a very, very special elite. Because I think even the very best find it difficult to stop those guys. No matter what you say that you're going to stop them, they're going to find a way. And someone like Erling will keep finding a way.
He scored another hat-trick, his sixth of the season, in that win over Burnley. There were stories last August that the Premier League managers had been phoning each other to ask for advice on stopping Haaland. Judging by his numbers this year, and by the advice we've heard over the last few minutes, it looks like nobody really has any answers. But maybe that's because there are no answers. And for City fans, that's a pretty exciting thought.
Hi there, this is Joe Royal speaking. You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast, and carry on doing so.
The Blue Moon Podcast. If City won't let you down on the pitch, let us let you down off it instead.
That was Sam Roscoe looking at what's been said about Haaland this season. Time now to look ahead to the coming games with Everton and Real Madrid. So go on then, Jack. Let's start with Everton. Tell me how you'd balance this week if you were Guardiola.
I've actually done a predicted team in today's newspaper, which I have forgotten.
Rather you than me. I have no idea what this team's
you know
going
what?
To look like.
It was... You know what? It was my idea. I don't know why I said it. Like, why on earth would you put yourself through that? Hang on, I'm just trying
to... So if you want the answer to that question, go and buy the paper, basically.
Yeah, in all bad news agents today. hang on, I've got it here. So I've got obviously got Edison. Edison, Walker, Akanji, Diaz, Ake, presuming that he's back. Still playing Rodri. And then the four in front of Rodri is Mahrez, De Bruyne, Alvarez, Foden, with Haaland up front.
Right.
So I think that's probably only four changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Because this is the interesting balance, I think, for this week, Dan. That, I think the big question is Haaland. Because, you think about Aguero in the past, and the number of times where, for the team, Aguero was genuinely rested or genuinely rotated out because the bigger picture says that he's going to play next week. Haaland, that hasn't happened yet. Maybe it never will happen, I don't know. But if it's going to happen, this is the sort of game where it might happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, he starts for me, but I wouldn't be too distraught if Alvarez started ahead of him. You know, it worked pretty well against Liverpool, and maybe Alvarez could be better suited to the way that Everton are likely to set up in this game. You know, I'm expecting them to dig in and, you know, defend the edge of their box really, really strongly, and it could be one of those games where Haaland doesn't see an awful lot of the ball, and maybe it would be helpful to have a player dropping in and linking up in the way that Alvarez is perhaps a little bit better at. But for me, I would still go with Haaland from the start. I think I would bring Mahrez, Foden, Alvarez, and Laporte all into the team. I'd probably give Walker a rest personally, and I probably wouldn't, even if Ake's fit, I wouldn't risk him for this. I'd probably save him and get Rico Lewis in the team, maybe. Maybe even give De Bruyne a rest. But yeah, Haaland starts for me, I think.
But he's been really worried about the Everton game for a couple of weeks. Keeps mentioning it, so I don't know whether it's one of those where he doesn't feel he can risk it.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, there's, if you're going to win a treble, then
you've got to use the squad, haven't you?
Games,
yeah.
There's certain games that you've got to roll the dice. You've got to go, right, well, I've got to trust these, you know, or you go and make 5, 6, 7 changes and you go, well, I trust these players to go and get me a result, because obviously you can't play the same team every 3 days for the next however long if you're going to win all three trophies.
Yeah, the 5, 6, 7 changes thing though does worry me, because you look at the past. It was always the FA Cup semi final in the past, and you know they were always coming up against pretty decent teams in like Liverpool and Chelsea. But the games where he's made those number of changes, it's just been quite disjointed. And you'd look at Everton games in the past, even last season. Everton were there for the taking when City went there last season, and they were what, a Rodri non-handball away from dropping points. So it's a really nervy game and a really nervy place, Jack.
Yeah, although the one thing I would say was, are Everton going to produce two performances of that ilk back-to-back?
Yeah.
After midweek?
Walloping Brighton, yeah.
Probably not. But then you sort of kind of gambling either way, aren't you? Because that's a law of averages thing, and there's, you know,
doesn't no mean such it's thing. Gonna
be,
yeah.
doesn't mean it's going to come off, does it? I don't know. You're right with the FA Cup semi-final thing, because the FA Cup semi-finals in recent years have been by and large abominations because they're dropped into a massive game and have never been able to handle the pace of it because they've not been playing in the weeks before. So I know I said I did a predicted team this morning, but I just can't. It's difficult to call it, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I don't think either would surprise you. If he made like loads of changes, or if he
went unchanged.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, you wouldn't be surprised either way.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the other side of it, Jack, in the Bernabeu, was it really warm? It looked really hot on the TV. I don't know if that'll have an effect.
Yeah, well, it was warmer for those of us that were wearing jeans, to be honest. In fact, I did a video for the Mail's Twitter after the match, which we have to do now. And the guy I sent it to that was uploading it onto Twitter said, "Oh, it looks really hot out there." I was like, "Right, thanks very much. I thought I looked all right, actually." He was like, no, not you. It's like, the camera's a bit like fuzzy, so I presumed it was the heat. I was like, right, okay, fine. But yeah, it was hot.
That's some quality backtracking there. I mean, the one thing I would say is I suspect City's players won't be wearing jeans on Sunday, so I think we might be all right on that front. The bigger picture stuff, Dan, obviously, title race, I said it at the start, 8 points to win it, 9 points to be absolutely sure. There is some leeway, but I guess, you know, you look beyond Everton and you fix your list being Chelsea at home, Brighton away and Brentford away. You kind of don't want to use that leeway, do you?
No, there is margin for error there. And I think I'm probably not alone in assuming that Arsenal were going to lose against Newcastle last week and that the margin for error would be even greater. And the fact that they did win that game unexpectedly was really annoying for me. It'd be really lovely if Brighton could do us a solid later on Sunday after we play Everton and get some points off Arsenal in that game. Yeah, I think the remit just has to be do everything we can to win every game and leave nothing to chance now, really. And, you know, going into this Everton game, I am nervous about it. I think the last time we lost there was the 4-0 defeat in Pep's first season. But it's usually a tough game and I'm always quite concerned about it. And I think they will have their backs up after that win over Brighton. It will have given them a huge boost. And I think they're kind of at their best when the pressure is off and they're the underdog, and especially kind of Sean Dyche teams are like that. I think Goodison Park is going to be right behind them, and it's going to be a tough game. We've got to try and quiet them down, dominate the ball, and we should be fine. You know, going into all these games, you think if City just play well and play their game, we'll be the better team and we should win. But it's just, you know, like we said, if they do make too many changes, it can lead to a disjointed performance. And we don't know if you're necessarily going to see the best version of City then. And that could present a problem. But yeah, I just want to try and win every game now, really. And we'll be fine.
Yeah. I don't know if you meant to do this, but you just made me think of a Sean Dyche game against City in the run-in in 2018 when City went to Burnley and it took Aguero, millimetres to get the ball over the line, and then they were hanging on. Don't want to put that fear of God into everyone, but, you know, this weekend.
Yeah, and Burnley weren't battling relegation then, were they? So there's an even different element to throw in the mix this time.
I think they've got a win on Sunday. I don't think they want to go into that final week, Brighton away and Brentford away, needing 6 points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. In terms of the picture then towards the Champions League, Jack, we talked about it briefly in the first part of the show. The fact that they brought a 1-1 back to the Etihad, that's, I think, the key difference between this season and last season is that in the back end of that game at the Bernabeu last season, Madrid had to score. And that was kind of almost the situation dictated that's how it ended up happening. Whereas this time around, it's in City's control that, and, you know, at the Etihad, City haven't lost a Champions League game at the Etihad since they lost to Lyon there when Arteta deputised for Guardiola.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's like you were saying with when you were mentioning the FA Cup semi-final before. I think things are aligning a little bit this year in a way that they haven't previously. So the FA Cup, Sheffield United, you can rest a few players. Next week, having the home leg second is just such a massive advantage, and one that they haven't, you know, obviously they didn't have last year, which makes it a completely different game. And you just wonder whether like little things like this are just, I don't know, it just feels a little bit different.
Are those the fine margins, yeah?
Yeah, it just feels a little bit different this time. And like, I don't know, I'm kind of confident that they're going to be able to get over the line in all the different competitions. And it is, I don't know, it just, maybe it's a small thing, or maybe it doesn't matter, but things have just, I don't know, a little bit easier for them in a way. Obviously, the Champions League draw hasn't been easy, has it?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll let you put that one to Real.
But no, it's me, but like, I don't know, yeah, maybe I might be talking absolute shite, to be fair, which is not unusual. But yeah, I don't know. It's just the home leg second against Real Madrid is, you'd far rather it than first, wouldn't you?
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk. Check out exclusive City interviews on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
How different do you think it'll be from the first leg, Dan? Or do you think it'll be a very similar sort of game with both teams setting up in a similar way?
I think our approach to it is going to be very different, and we'll really go for the jugular from the first minute. I think the atmosphere is going to be mega at the Etihad, and I think we'll try and do what we did to Arsenal and overwhelm Real Madrid straight from the off. But I think, you know, Real Madrid aren't Arsenal. They are experienced at this level. You know, they are tricky customers. They know exactly what to do. And I think we have to be prepared for the possibility that they will be able to handle what we throw at them. And we also can't let them kind of play around us easily like we did the other night at times, and give the likes of Vinicius space to run into on the break. And I kind of feel like, thinking back to the 4-3 game against them last season, I feel like our kind of whole modus operandi this season has been based on that game and how to improve on how things went that night. All right, we won the game. It was a fantastic night, but it kind of didn't serve us that well in the long run. And I think Pep has been trying to work our way throughout the season of how we can play that well, create chances, score goals, while also, well, score more goals ideally with Haaland there as well, while also kind of maintaining control of the game and keeping it tight defensively. And I think the whole season has almost been kind of building towards this game now, and it's going to be interesting to see what we can take from sort of the way we've built and what we've learned from it, and whether we can improve on that.
Yeah. This is a question from Pete. It's probably more for you, Dan. He's got in touch on Twitter to say, do you have any concerns about the Madrid second leg atmosphere, especially after the way tickets were sold to anyone without proper criteria?
I don't personally, no. I mean, ideally, the tickets would have been distributed a lot more fairly, and I'm really gutted for anyone who regularly goes to the match and has been to a lot of games this season and hasn't been able to get a ticket for this one. But, you know, I don't think it's necessarily going to be full of tourists, and I think, you know, these so-called tourists get a bit of a bad rap sometimes, and I think the atmosphere takes care of itself on nights like this, really. And you know, I think there's going to be some pre-match display like there was against Arsenal the other week. I think everyone's going to be really up for it, and I think the Etihad has quietly become quite a fearsome ground and quite a fearsome venue on nights like this, and a place that other teams are getting quite scared of coming to. And it doesn't mean that the atmosphere is always amazing for every single game, but when it's good, it's really, really good. And I think every City fan understands that we've got a big role to play in this game on Wednesday night. And yeah, just got to get that anthem booed and then have nothing but encouragement and positivity. And I think it's going to be, yeah, Real Madrid are not going to like playing in that ground, on that ground.
Yeah. Right, well, time to put your money where your mouth is, boys, because two games down this week and two wins on the charity bet. First, Chris Higginbottom added £100 to the pot by correctly guessing the 2-1 win over Leeds. Then it was my 1-1 with Real Madrid that came in on Tuesday night to add another £55 to the kitty. That means we've raised £1,015 for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're collecting food and money donations for the Trussell Trust to help people in poverty in Manchester, and they'll be outside the Etihad ahead of weekend home games. They've got one more to go. Go and see them in a fortnight ahead of the Chelsea game. game. But first, it's Everton and Real Madrid to predict. Let's start with Everton. I've gone for, similar to that Burnley one in 2019, actually, a nervy 1-0 win, which is 7-1 and £70, if I'm right. Dan, what have you gone for?
A nervy 2-1.
Nervy 2-1 is 8-1 and £80. Jack, I know you wanted 2-1, but you were a little bit late in there. So what have you gone for?
Yeah, I was. I've gone for a less nervy 3-1.
Less nervy 3-1, I'll take it.
Even though I think it is going to be a nervy 2-1.
2-1, yeah. but still, if it does finish 3-1, it's 10-1 and £100 if you're right. You two seem to have lost your minds with the Real Madrid game. So we're going for my 2-1 to City first, which is 15-2 and £75. But I really hope that one of yours comes in, because Dan, you've gone for...
3-2 to City.
Which is 22-1 and £220 if you're right. Jack, I mean... You're lining up the biggest win we've ever had, if you're right. So come on then.
Well, I did actually want 3-2, to be honest, but I've gone for 4-3 instead.
4-3. My nerves will be shot, but at least it'll add £900 to the kitty, because it's 90-1 if you're right. So fingers crossed for that one. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change, and for more on gambling responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now then, as we near the end of the season, it's time to check in with our EDS expert, Sean Blinkhorn, to find out more about the players who have impressed in the younger age groups and to catch up with the youth players who are out on loan. I started by asking him about how the different age groups had done this year.
So the way that we stand as we come towards the end of the season with the academy is the under-21s have won the Premier League 2 for the third year in a row, which is really good with them. And the under-18s have won the Premier League North, the under-18 Premier League North, for the fourth year in a row now. And also there's the national title, which they won for a third straight time.
Yeah, and I mean, so you look at kind of where the academy is at then at the moment, that seems pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether that's becoming quite normalised now that we win these titles, because it is, you know, three years in a row. And it just doesn't seem to generate the sort of news and headlines that it once did. But I wanted to argue for the importance of competing and winning at these age groups. And it's not just within the age group system where we're having success with that. This is so a lot of this will be stuff that people already know. But I just wanted to kind of collect it all together as a big pot of experience that the youngsters are starting to have now in the academies, and not just, like I say. We've got a lot of young players that striving and competing for success at the end of the season, even if they don't reach it, to have the players in that conversation so late on, to me, can only be a benefit. The line I've used before is these are young apprentices in a results-based business, and what they will need is that success. So while we have had some failed loans in the past, some of them not great, some of them this year haven't been too wonderful. We've got about 10 fewer players on loan this year than we have in previous years. Used to be hanging around the late 30s, I think. Now it's in like the kind of late 20s. When it comes to loans that are actually starting to make an impact, we think back to Callum Doyle, who I came on talking about last year. Was a real trailblazer in going out and getting himself a loan in his kind of second year as a scholar, as you call it, your second year out of school. He basically forced that he went to Sunderland. He wanted to play there. He played for a lot of the season, faded towards the end, as you might suspect with some youngsters, but still was involved in their promotion that year. That, to me, I suppose you could look back as a bit of a door opening. You're breaking through the glass ceiling, however you want to say it, in terms of loans for City, because much like in this year, we've got the story of James McAtee and Tommy Doyle, especially in McAtee's case, seemingly from everybody who seems to be in the know, forced that issue. He said, no, I want to go alone. I don't want to play a bit part here. And I've come on the podcast this year and talked about how I was a little worried about that, how that loan seemed to be going at the start of the year. But my word, has he turned it round.
I was going to say, it's you can't avoid, every week you're looking and you see more goals and headlines from him, aren't you?
More goals, yeah. He's been great. He's been really great. I watched him a few times this season. I don't always get to watch loads of the loan players, but I've managed to watch James a lot. And as much as, you know, the footballing ability's always been there, But he has turned that round there, genuinely turned that round. And I like to see little glimpses into the attitude, forcing the issue, turning the situation round, becoming a top player and winning promotion, being involved at the rough end of the season. You've got to think about Taylor Harwood-Bellis as well, winning the championship with Burnley. That's just as impressive, if not more, you could say. You know, it's only one place in the table, I suppose, but championships, titles, especially at a younger age group, lower down the leagues. Even further back, you've got probably one of the strongest keepers I remember seeing in the academy, other than Angus Gunn quite a while back, is James Trafford. He's looked great.
Now, there's an interesting thing with James Trafford as well, because I had a Bolton fan who works at the centre I play football at recently say to me, have you got any information about James Trafford? We'd love him to stay. He's fantastic. But he said he's off at the end of the season. Have you heard anything about that? Do you know what that is?
No, I'm not quite sure about that. I'm not quite sure where he'd go. I know he's said in the past that basically if he's to come back to City, he will be challenging Edison. You know, that's the kind of mentality. And again, a good insight into how hungry some of these young players are, that they're not prepared to sit about and wait for these things. They want, no, I want to be competing. When I come back, I'm good enough. I've been involved, like this year, winning the EFL trophy along with Lucas Beattie as well. So again, another player striving for success towards the end of the season. I just wanted to throw in that he's not really a youth player from City, but Issa Kabore has been pushing for the Ligue 1 title with Marseille. I wanted to put that in just to show that the reality of that, and maybe some of our own homegrown younger players, will drive up value in sell-on rather than, you know, it being a catalyst for getting some of these players into the first team. So I do understand that difference, if you know what I mean. At the same time, striving for success and striving for to be as close to the top of the game as possible at any time is only going to benefit us. So you've even got like I completely lost track of the amount of players we've got buybacks on and what have you. But
Lavi is the standout though, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, he is. He is. And he's looked excellent when I've managed to watch him this season. I know they're struggling a little bit, but he does. Hasn't there been reports that like Southampton can only play the way that they want if Lavi is there?
Yeah, and it's something, I mean, we've had Sam Tai on the podcast a few times this season, who is not a Southampton fan, but he covers the club. And he's talking about how Lavia basically makes them tick. And yeah, sure, they've struggled this season, but without him, they would have struggled a hell of a lot more than they have done. I mean, where do you stand on Lavia and the situation with, I mean, the other side of this is that the elephant in the room is Calvin Phillips, who, you know, let's be honest here, it hasn't worked out so far. It may not work out at all. The club may look at moving him on and looking for somebody in that position again. Could they exercise the buyback for Lavia?
He couldn't even trust Phillips to come on in the last couple of minutes against Leeds.
Yeah.
He had to drag Rodri kicking and screaming back on for his 3,000th game of the season or whatever it is at this point. Bless him. So I think there's a very real possibility, that if that is to come to pass, that we could go in for Lavia. Is he going to take it? Is he going to sit on the bench behind Rodri when he could go to somewhere like, picking a name out of the hat, Aston Villa, and probably play every week? I don't know, but I would like to see him come back, because he's a player that made that Premier League 2 side really good when I was watching it pretty much every other week. But that doesn't really mean anything. But he looks that good for Southampton that it's probably worth a go.
Yeah.
Along similar sort of lines, players that, well, not that might go, but when another side to this of what you see more and more recently is our players aren't, while they're not getting sent out on useless loans to the middle of Holland somewhere, or, you know, and then just to return having played 7 games 12 months later and earn nothing, just as they're now starting to my mind, get to better and better loan opportunities, we're also seeing our players touted more and more. I'm seeing rumours, transfer rumours from our really young players. They're going XYZ, they're going here, they could go there, they could go, oh, this manager's a great admirer of. I saw Kean Breckin, who I thought has had a pretty good season for the sides that he's played for. I thought he's, on occasion, he's looked really good. He's kind of like a box-to-box midfielder. I thought he'd look really good. And then I suddenly started seeing a couple of transfer rumours popping up, and he's barely played for the Premier League 2 side. Yeah. But when I saw that, he's probably played a bit more now, to be fair. And then Carlos Borges as well, who we spoke about before this season, who is basically the only remaining one of the youngsters that are still at the club that still kind of gets headlines here and there. With one or two exceptions, he's still scoring goals as they zeroed in on the title. I mean, that's just another indication of the way things are going and the turnaround. Now, when it comes for the future for the academy, the head of the academy, Jason Wilcox, he's leaving at the end of the current season as we stand. So there is a bit of a reset to come in academy terms. But I think everything's on the up, let's put it that way. And with the titles, which aren't really making headlines anymore, and I'm starting to think people are getting a bit bored of, there are signs away from that that the academy and the players that we are generating have a promising future in the game.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
That was Sean Blinkhorn. We'll squeeze in a few questions from Twitter before we finish. Get in touch for next week at Blue Moon Podcast. Josh says, after Edin Dzeko impressed for Inter in the other semi-final this week, it got me wondering what his legacy should be at City now that several years has passed. Dan, what do you think?
I think he was a great striker for us who provided some fantastic memories, and I'll always have a really special place in my heart for Dzeko. You know, you think of the goals in the 6-1 at Old Trafford and the four goals he scored away at Spurs in particular, they really stand out. At the same time, I felt he was quite a limited player when he played for City, and I thought his first touch was pretty shocking at times. And I think it was the right time for him to go when he left. And I actually remember thinking at the time that we'd made a great upgrade when we signed Wilfred Bonny, and obviously that didn't quite pan out that way. you know, Bonny was absolutely awful in the end. But yeah, it was a bit of a shame to see him go, but I did kind of feel like it was the right time. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of City fans felt the same at the time, and there's been a little bit of revision about him in the years since. I think he was a really great goal scorer, but never a top-tier striker for me, really. And I think, you know, the goal he scored on Wednesday for Inter was classic Dzeko. It reminded me of that one he scored in the 3-0 win at Old Trafford. And I wouldn't feel too happy about coming up against him in the final. But yeah, I think his legacy was a great striker, but not one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, Jack, I don't know if you were covering City when Dzeko was still around, were you?
No, I wasn't, no.
No.
Nor Boney, actually.
Yeah, well, lucky you. I did think it would be there would be a good sense of irony, wouldn't there, if football heritage took its place and City managed to get past Real Madrid, and then in the final, Inter stank the place out, but Dzeko got the winner.
Yeah, it's he got asked about it last night, didn't he? Were about potentially facing City in the final, and he was like, I really hope so, yeah. And you think, yeah, that's exactly the sort of thing that had happened. Like, John Stones would inexplicably fall over and Dzeko would just walk it into the net, refuse to celebrate, and then we'd all be doing inquests on where it's all gone wrong. I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes.
Imagine that, scoring the winner in the Champions League final but not being able to celebrate out of respect for your former club. I don't think that's ever been done before, has it?
Yeah, apologetic hands to finish there. Yeah.
Well, until it would have been a muted celebration until he heard Dan say he's not a top striker. Sod it, I am celebrating.
Yeah, he'll have Dan's face on his shirt underneath, just so that when he's ready to lift it up, he can point it to the camera.
Yeah. Why always Dan?
Let's finish with this from Eric on Twitter. Since Alfie Haaland was escorted from his seat against Real Madrid, I wondered if you guys had ever been asked to leave anything football related. I don't know. We might get some funny stories here. Over to you guys. Anything?
I was getting some very, very funny looks on Monday night, actually, in Madrid, when we all got turfed out of the Bernabeu about 30 seconds after the press conference finished. And I had to file my stuff on a step on the street next to a massive roundabout. And like locals looking at me going, what on earth is this fella doing? Why is he wearing jeans?
I feel like that's common though in the Bernabeu, isn't it? Is it not a thing where we see English journalists all the time filing from like the streets of Spain?
Yeah, but mine was actually real. It happened, wearing the photos that you see on Twitter or stage.
Fair enough. Yeah, and you were wearing jeans inexplicably. So
yeah,
yeah. Dan, anything been kicked out of anywhere that you shouldn't have been?
No, I mean, I was practically kicked into Main Road a few times back in the bad old days, but never been thrown out really. I did escort myself out of Old Trafford once, actually, after me and my dad went to watch City play there, and we had tickets in the home end in the Stretford end. It was the one when Hatem Trabelsi scored for City, if you remember that one.
Yeah, yeah.
A 3-1 defeat, and United scored really early, and the locals judged from our lack of celebration that we weren't United fans pretty quickly and were making some very threatening remarks towards us. So we decided to cut our losses and leave, and just went. Well, we actually went and watched the game on the concourse on the TV screens instead. But yeah, apart from that, nothing. I'm very well behaved at football, but I am going to Goodison Park this weekend. So maybe that's the famous last words. I'll end up getting arrested or something. Having said that,
get yourself chucked out of Goodison, and we'll reconvene next week and find out how it happened.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm just trying to think of like anything that's happened to me as an away fan when I've been watching my team. There was one, you know, the underpass at Wolves.
Yeah.
As you go back to the train station, that there was a hairy moment there where we got sort of like surrounded by about 8 Wolves fans, and I was about 18, 19 at the time. I had a lit cigarette in my hand and big boots on. I was like, "Am I gonna have to go all Joey Barton here? Is this is this gonna be required?" But thankfully not.
Thankfully not. Yeah. So yeah, we'll have more tales of Jack and Dan's football scraps soon. but for now, that's it for this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to my guests, Dan Burke.
Always a pleasure.
And Jack Gorn.
Thank you very much.
There's a clip of this week's Patreon show coming up, so stay tuned for that. I'll be back next week after the second leg with Madrid. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
I ended up going to Dennis Irwin's testimonial at Old Trafford, but yeah, I think that was 2 weeks before the start of the season. And even then, I mean, I've sat like in the away end. It felt like he had a bit of an aura about him, and I'm not sure whether that's just because he had red boots on, and I just thought, wow, he's got the balls to wear red boots at Old Trafford playing for City. And then this Sunderland game, he rocked up in a pair of like yellow or orange boots, and even that, I thought, none of these City players have done that before. But before this game, I remember walking around Main Road, around my side with my dad beforehand, and there were sort of these sort of knock-off shops that they used to have by the chippy on the corner that were just basically old terraced houses with a rail upstairs with Fruit of the Loom t-shirts on with City printed on them or whatever it was. But I remember going upstairs in one of them before the match, and they had Weyer 22 unofficial t-shirts, One Shop 23 unofficial t-shirts. And I just remember there being a buzz, and I'd never seen that before. I'd seen loads of, you know, like you go on holiday, you see international teams and the bigger European teams having unofficial merchandise, and now City had it, and that was a sign of how far we've come.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.